Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. It was more than 20 years ago, Jerry Dennis wrote the award-winning book, The Living Great Lakes, Searching for the Heart on the Inland Seas. It's a new edition out now. In it, he updates readers on the fate of the boat and crew with whom he sailed across the Great Lakes, talks a little about what's changed with the Great Lakes over that time period. He still lives near the shore of Lake Michigan. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Have you had adventures on or around the Great Lakes? Do you feel drawn to those massive bodies of water? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Jerry Dennis, welcome. Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it very much.
My pleasure, Larry. Hello.
You know, I read your book 20 years ago. I'm pretty sure we did an interview 20 years ago. And here it is 20 years later. I read the book again. And it holds really, really well. I thought the way that you talk about the lakes, you weave the history of those areas around the lakes was so fascinating, and some really riveting shall we say, dangerous events that may have taken place either way a long time ago or right while you were sailing around the lakes. It just made it fascinating. So thanks for reissuing this and reintroducing me. Appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you.
Well, let's talk about that trip for a minute. In 2020, you joined the crew of the schooner, the Malabar, to sail across. You did four of the five Great Lakes. What did you set out hoping to experience on that trip?
It's funny because it seems like yesterday. It's so vivid in my memory. I mean, it was such an amazing trip, and I learned so much. I had spent a couple of years circling the lakes, trying to find an entry into this book. I had hundreds of pages of notes and drafts, and just couldn't find my way into the heart of the lakes, which is why I chose that subtitle, until I met the captain and first mate of the Malabar and talked my way on board and served as a crew member to help sail this schooner through the lakes and ultimately to Bar Harbor, Maine, to deliver it to its new owners. But I wanted to see the lakes from the water. And a 19th century style schooner seemed ideal to me because those were the long haul truckers of the 19th century. And that was a big part of the commercial history of the lakes, took place on boats just like that. So I felt like it gave me a really unique perspective.
Hi-O Nettle, the guy that you mentioned, he's a fascinating guy to me.
Oh, absolutely. He was something else, and he gave me many hours of pleasure sitting when we always chose the night shift to be on board, be up on deck at the helm, and we'd sit next to each other, and he would talk for hours and hours and hours. He'd had an amazing, eventful life, and he was imaginative and funny and well spoken. We've stayed friends all these years.
That is really cool. He was kind of superstitious guy.
a lot of sailors, definitely.
Is that right? Didn't he have a horseshoe on the bow of the boat or something like that?
Yeah, he had it over his stateroom. And he wanted me to understand that you always had to have the horseshoe pointed up so that the luck stayed in the horseshoe. If you turn it upside down, and he would get really indignant about this, he'd say, some people turn it upside down, the luck pours out. And he just did not want anything like that to happen.
Doug in Madison has a comment for us. Let's go there. Hi, Doug.
Hey, Larry. I just wanted to talk about Washington Island, how amazing it is, and the salmon fishing that goes on around Washington and Rock Island. Lake Michigan's fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I've been to Washington Island, and that's a fascinating place. But, yeah, the fishing in, around there and all through the northern, all through Lake Michigan in total is really good.
Yeah, it really is. I've been there, too, and I've enjoyed every minute that I've spent there, as a matter of fact, Washington Island, and done some fishing and caught some pretty nice fish on Lake Michigan as well with some charter boats. It was always a lot of fun to be on the water. The Great Lakes of Michigan and Superior, the Great Lakes contain nearly a fifth of the world's fresh water. And what are the shores? Something like 10,000 miles of shoreline?
Yeah, approximately.
How do you explain the size and importance of the Great Lakes to people?
That was a big part of the motivation for this and a couple of other books I've written. Any of us who live here have had the experience of having visitors who've never seen the lakes in our presence and watching how shocked they are that they can't be, you can't see across them, for instance, that they look like oceans. They are vast, and people who haven't seen them just have no idea. They see these see them on a map. And I get calls once in a while from people wanting to kayak across Lake Michigan and wondering where a good place to start from is. And I said, you don't want to do it, first of all, and they just don't understand. They are big lakes capable of huge waves.
You know, I just did, to go along with that, I think you mentioned in the book that Superior itself is 350 miles long. So I just went online this morning to check the length of Wisconsin, and the length of Wisconsin is 311 miles. So just to give a perspective of the size of it, I mean, here we are, it's longer than the state of Wisconsin by about 45 miles or so.
Yeah. 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 If you go from the western tip of Lake Superior to the eastern end of the St. Lawrence River, you're covering a quarter of the continent.
I get just absolutely amazing. Brad in Appleton has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Brad.
Hello, guys. How's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I just had an interesting story and experience that I got to experience with the Great Lakes. Quite a few years ago, I worked on an episode of Expedition Unknown on the Discovery Channel with Josh Gates.
Yeah.
And, he did an episode called, I believe it was called Ghost Ship of the Great Lakes. And I was a production assistant. We filmed mainly up around the UP, Manistee, Michigan. It was just one of the coolest experiences of my life. He actually went so far as to go down into the lake in a little yellow submarine that I got to watch being dropped into the lake. It was pretty cool. He didn't actually end up finding the ghost ship, but... we had a lot of fun filming that, and we went to a couple lighthouses and explored the history of this lost ship.
Brad, thanks a lot for calling. Well, you know, there were a lot of lost ships on the Great Lakes, and you get into it quite a bit. And November, of course, is probably the worst month.
Yeah, definitely.
Of course, the Edmund Fitzgerald sunk on November 10th in 1975. And you tell a story. This is one of the more riveting stories that I can remember, packed into, I don't know, two or three pages I think this was in 1998, you attended a reunion of family members of those who perished on the Edmund Fitzgerald, and you went to that gathering, and you heard a guy by the name of John Lufkins, I believe, and he told the story. It didn't have to do with the Edmund Fitzgerald, but it did have to do with that night of him saving some people, a couple of people, on the lake. And that was the most riveting story. The hair stood up in the back of my neck when I was reading what that man went through.
It took place at the Great Lakes Shipwreck Museum at Whitefish Point in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And that's the U.S. point that's closest to where the Fitzgerald went down. You can look out from the museum and see the general vicinity where she sank. And there were probably 40 people maybe in the audience, and you could have heard a pin drop as John Lufkins told his story about being out there in a 16-foot open boat with an outboard motor gathering gill nets, he and his 18-year-old brother-in-law. And that storm came up so fast that they didn't have a chance to get to shore and had to take harbor, find shelter on a little island in the offshore there that has clearly saved their lives. And then to go back out and rescue two other fishermen whose boat had capsized, and they were just hanging on to the hull in these 18, 20-foot waves. Crazy story.
Crazy, crazy story. I could hardly believe it. I think John Lufkin could hardly believe it either when he finally made it back to shore.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he kept talking about it as a miracle that, you know, it was 20 years later, and he still was almost shaking with emotion, remembering how close they came to drowning.
Yeah, he said he was he laid on the shore and thought of himself as the luckiest SOB in the world at that point, because he had no idea where he was, and he comes to the top of a 20-foot wave, and there's the island popped right in front of him, and he had no idea where it was. No. Oh, my goodness me. Well, that was one of the many stories from your book that I really, really enjoyed. Well, you observed, I think it was, well, in 2003, the book came out, and climate change was well documented by that time, but causes, I think at the time, causes of climate change were still being debated. And we know a lot more about how climate change is impacting the Great Lakes today than we did back then.
Yeah, definitely. There wasn't a lot of empirical data at that time in 2003 about it. There was a lot of speculation, a lot of computer models predicting what would happen. But as it turns out, none of those computer models were severe enough. They were looking at much longer timelines to get where we are now with the water temperatures warmed as much as they are. That was a big part of the reason I wanted to do this new edition and update that, because I just barely touched on the subject in 2003.
Yeah, it's if you look at I think we're losing an average of 14 or 15 days of winter every decade.
Yeah, that's crazy. There was some evidence of that happening shortly after the book came out. I live on Grand Traverse Bay in northern Lower Peninsula of Michigan, about at the tip of the Little Finger. And we happen to have been a harbor. The bay was a harbor for coal deliveries for over 100 years. And so there are records going back to around the 1880s of ice cover on the bays, because the boats couldn't come in if the bays were covered. So they would have to get reports. And it's really consistent for all those years up until about 1975. There were seven winters out of 10, the bays would freeze over and the boats couldn't come in. They'd have to plan ahead to get plenty to last the winter, because seven out of 10 times you're not going to get in there. Since 1975, the number of frozen, you know, the bays freeze over more like once out of every 10 years. And we've been, I think we're at about 7 years now that we haven't had ice all the way across the bay. And that, you know, that's pretty distinctive change. And you can see it graphed. It's dramatic at 1975. And incidentally, the study that brought that to my attention was from some hydrologists at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, I believe. And they had also studied records from a lake in Japan that kept records for 500 years. And that was consistent with their records, and with a lake in Switzerland that had similar records for hundreds of years. All of the time, there was consistent freeze over until about 1975, and then the warming climate started kicking in, which is global, and you know, it takes us across three continents.
And with the ice not there, the water is warming, and warming water has an impact on anything that's in the lake, I would guess.
It does. It does. It affects, you know, spawning and life histories of most of the organisms in the lake. Plus, it opens them up to new invasive species from regions of the world that are warmer. That's a real concern in Lake Superior, because Superior so far has been able to stay clear of zebra mussels and quagga mussels and round gobies and spiny water flea that are, you know, in all the other lakes, because the cold water kept them out. But now Lake Superior is one of the fastest warming big lakes in the world, and it's just a matter of time before those invaders find a home there.
Jerry Dennis, our guest today, his book, it's the 20th anniversary edition with a new introduction. It's titled The Living Great Lakes, subtitled Searching for the Heart of the Inland Seas. You can join in, and I hope you do. Give us a call with your questions or comments or maybe your experiences to share on the Great Lakes. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking with Jerry Dennis about the 20th anniversary edition with a new introduction of his book, The Living Great Lakes. Again, questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Let's take a question from Paul in Toma. Paul, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call. First thing, I want to kind of brag a little bit. I get to go live up there all next year by the town of Frieda. I don't know if he knows anything about that area. So I hope to get his book, sit back in a lazy chair and read it. But I guess I'm calling about, does he know anything about the monsters, the legends of the lake? I've heard of a few legends, where they may have originated from. I think there used to be pirates on the lake, more modern day pirates, but anything that might be kind of historical in that respect.
Okay. Paul, thanks for calling. Jerry?
Yeah, there are legends of monsters going back centuries. Of course, Native Americans believed in them. If you've ever seen the rock paintings up on the north shore of Lake Superior, there's a dragon-like creature that they felt was the cause of storms on the lakes. There have also been, you know, rumors about more modern sea creatures more like Nessie, you know, but no evidence of that. They're just the stories that are going around. Mm-hmm. But there were pirates. There were definitely robbers on the lakes back in the sailing days. I've heard many stories about ghost ships that, there's no real evidence, but people love stories like that. One of the enduring legends is of a cache of Confederate gold dollars that were lost in a shipwreck during the Civil War. Apparently, some Union soldiers had stolen it. Either that, or one other version of the legend says that the Confederacy wanted to ship the money up to Canada to try to purchase the services of mercenaries to help them in the battle. In any event, the money, as far as I know, has never been found, if it existed. But again, you're going to get stories like this.
Well, yeah. And it I can think of, days when there's fog or a heavy mist on the lake, and somebody might actually see a ship on the lake, and it probably looked like a ghost ship, maybe, you know?
Yeah. You can't tell distances sometimes when the light is a certain way, or when, as you say, when there's fog or mist. What looks like it's far away could be close, or vice versa. Yeah. So, yeah.
Could happen. Paul, thank you for calling. Martha in Menominee will have you join in. Thank you for calling.
Oh, you're welcome, Larry. This is right up my alley. Every November, I tune in. You know, I listen to the stories about Edmund Fitzgerald. I get out the guitar and I run through the song, you know, a few times. But I want to come to the museum up there at Whitefish Bay. We've been planning this like a camping trip for years now, and it looks like we're going to get to go. So I was wondering if Jerry could give me like a tour guide, like a suggested things to do if I come up to the museum, when would be a good time to go, and maybe Jerry could tell me, you know, what kind of things to do up there and what to check out.
Sure. I've been there many times. It's one of my favorite areas of the Upper Peninsula. If you're camping, you know, a good choice is Tequamanon Falls State Park. The falls are spectacular. You get a good view of them from the hiking trails. The problem is it's very popular, so you need to make reservations. And I would not try to go during the 4th of July weekend. It's impossible. The little town of Paradise on the way up to Whitefish Point on the same road is fun, interesting little place that feels like it's fallen out of time. It doesn't feel any different than it seemed when the first time I saw it, when I was there with my dad when I was a kid back in the probably in about the mid 1960s. It seems the same. There is no real difference that I could tell. And it has a couple motels and a little grocery store and some gift shops. They have a blueberry festival every year. I think that's in August, which is my kids still talk about because the parade was parade, put it that way. So yeah, there's lots to explore up there. There's great the Lake Superior beaches west of Whitefish Point are spectacular. They're some of the most pristine, wide open sandy beaches on all of the Great Lakes.
Martha, thanks for calling. And just to go along with that, we got an email from Steve earlier that I hadn't gotten to yet. And Steve wonders, is there yet established a run of hiking or camping trails around the Great Lakes, especially the U.S.-Canada cooperation with maybe around a full shoreline, the full shoreline of Lake Superior, as I think something he's interested in.
Oh, it's a great idea. It hasn't come to pass yet. The North Country Trail covers a good chunk of the southern shore of Lake Superior in Michigan and Wisconsin. But the Canadian side is pretty rugged up there. There's high rocky bluffs. So if there was a trail, it would have to veer inland for, you know, long stretches. But it would be fantastic if it ever comes to fruition. It would be fantastic.
And Zori had emailed too about two rivers. Point Beach State Park and Neshota Beach Park have a great line of recreation trails, great for biking or camping or shoreline viewing, kayaking in shallow water, swimming in sand beaches, also connected to the Manitowoc Shoreline Trail as well. So beautiful recreation that not enough people know about in Zori's mind.
Yeah, that, you know, that's one of the big changes in the last 20 years. There were very few, relatively speaking, compared to now, there were fewer trails of that sort. There were the Rails to Trails programs, for instance, were just getting started to convert old railroad lines into biking paths. And this is, it's happening all over now. There's links taking place that are taking short stretches of paths and joining up with others with the intention of eventually circling all of the lakes.
You know, we're talking about sand, the beaches and so forth reminded me about sand mining, and you discuss that in the book. For decades, sand around the dunes along the Lake Michigan shoreline have been mined and sold. What were they using the sand for, and what's been the impact?
Yeah, they used it for industrial purposes. A lot of it went to Detroit to use for casting of cast iron parts like engine blocks. The sand had to be, you know, they used sand to surround the molten iron. And they liked this Lake Michigan sand because it's actually the sand left from the ancient ocean millions of years ago. So it's been worn to almost round. A lot of sand in more, you know, newer sand has sharp corners and doesn't work as well for industrial purposes. I would guess it doesn't pour as well, for instance. So, yeah, there's always been a hungry market for it. The effects have been pretty dramatic. I spent a few weeks in Indiana Dunes at the very southern shore of Lake Michigan, and it's a 15-mile stretch of Lake Michigan that's national park, and in the middle of it there's a state park also, but it's all protected dune lands. The biggest dune down there, Old Baldy, is gone. Yeah. they harvested it right down to the almost the water level. Before the local community got together, said, let's stop this while we can, because this is a priceless natural treasure, these dunes, and we want to protect the rest of them. So they managed to save a good chunk of them. But same thing has happened up along the Michigan shore, the dunes. It's dunes almost continuously from Indiana Dunes up to Sleeping Bear Dunes where near my house, and then up to the very top of Lake Michigan as well. Especially down in southwest Michigan, that shoreline has been mined a fair amount.
And there are some birds that have been affected. I think it's piping plovers, for example. They're shore birds and become endangered due to the loss of the dune habitat. So is it really regulated? I mean, what people have done is, you know, establish parks and so forth to protect it that way.
That's really the only way to ensure that they won't be lost. Local communities will you know, form coalitions and try to sue the companies to halt it, at least until it can be studied. And that's been successful in a couple of cases.
Yeah. Mary in Independence, Wisconsin, has something for us. So let's go to Mary. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. There was a question about camping along the Lake Superior or the Great Lakes. And in Minnesota, roughly from Duluth up to the Canadian border is the Superior Hiking Trail. It runs along the Sawtooth Mountain Range there, and it goes in and out of the state parks. You can arrange for pickup and drop-off. There's lodges and things along the way.
That sounds fascinating. I didn't know about it. I've spent some time on that shoreline, and it's beautiful. It's one of the prettiest shores of all the Great Lakes. Yeah, it's well worth checking out.
Minnesota Superior Hiking Trail. That sounds great. Mary, thank you very much for calling. Tom in Columbus, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. My wife and I kind of discovered the peninsula up into Door County and our beautiful Peninsula State Park and some of the wonderful shoreline up there kind of late in life after the kids were grown and gone and school paid for and all that stuff. We started to venture out a little bit, and we love to go to the along the shoreline. I mean, the Harrington Beach and in those areas, and they're just, it's just phenomenal. We go in November up to Door, and we've been pinched by, we get that first into the second week every year, and we've been pinched by that weather that's turned quickly before, and but we just love how that water can go from a jade green kind of foamy and a little bit choppy to just slate gray, black, and sure, I mean, it's just beautiful. We just love it. So I would encourage anybody to spend some time along our lakes and get your state park sticker and get outside.
Tom, thanks for calling. Jerry, a comment?
Yeah, that brings to mind another misunderstanding about the Great Lakes that I have encountered countless times all over the country, and probably, and you encounter it across the oceans as well, and everywhere in the world, that anybody that is aware of the Great Lakes. This book, by the way, has been translated into Korean, so I'm looking forward to seeing what the Korean readers think. But many people think that the lakes are polluted beyond hope. They remember the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland catching fire in 1968 and being, you know, the Johnny Carson show. Johnny Carson got a lot of laughs about that. He called Cleveland the mistake by the lake. And that sticks in people's minds and other things. And, you know, there are a lot of pollution problems, and there are places that are in trouble. But the vast majority of the lakes themselves and of the shoreline are still pretty spectacular, as the caller brings to our attention. The Door County shoreline is wonderful. It is beautiful. And it's not alone. There's thousands of miles of great shoreline still.
And you do address that and talk about that in your book, especially, I think, around Lake Erie and your experiences there. And I just want to go back to the book a minute, because when you do, as you cross through these lakes, we not only learn about your experience in the crossing and what's going on in presently, you do a wonderful job of digging back into the history and really the fascinating history of these of all this. It's really, really remarkable. Sumner, in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Sumner.
Yes, hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, so I've spent the last 50 years on Lake Superior, mainly in the Apostle Islands, studying colonial water birds and shorebirds. And 1974, we found the first nesting piping plover on Long Island. But that's not why I'm calling. I had an unusual experience about 7 years ago, which kind of haunts me to this day. And that is, I was doing a marsh bird survey on Madeline Island at a place called Big Bay Lagoon. And I did this survey. This was a marsh bird, a rail and bittern survey. It was done late at night, starting about 11 o'clock. And when I got done, as I was heading back to the place where I could take my kayak out and walk up to my campsite, I noticed a bright light coming through the pines, and I was amazed. I was thinking, the time now was about, close to 1 a.m, and I was thinking, who's out at this time of night? Who's walking along the beach? So I decided to investigate and went out I got to the place where I was going to take my kayak out, got out, and I walked toward the pines and got out to the pines, and there, what should I see but a large crystalline bowl-shaped object, probably about, I would say maybe, I would estimate it was about a quarter mile away, but probably farther, because I was so tired, and probably about 1,000 feet or so above the water. I knew it wasn't the moon because the moon had been a sliver over my right shoulder. And so I just parked myself in the sand and watched this thing. It was like a crystalline bowl-shaped object. It did not move at all. One friend of mine said, well, it was probably a weather balloon, but there was nothing visibly attached to it anywhere. And so I had no explanation for it. A Native American elder friend of mine said, well, remember, consider yourself blessed. You've had a visit with the great spirit of the lake. And that was sort of his explanation of it. But I'm just wondering, have you had any unusual sightings or reports of something similar to that?
No, I've never seen anything like that. And I don't think I've even heard of anything like that. That's really interesting.
Yeah, interesting story, Sumner. Well, maybe somebody else has, and we'll hear from them. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Bob in Lake Nabagamon, we'll go to you next. Hi, Bob.
Afternoon. I tell you, speaking of spiritual things, if you ever kayak the Brule River.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
We got two yas.
Well, if you take the final portion, it's about a 2.5 to 3 hour, depending on water level, downstream, which is actually north, because the Brule flows north into Lake Superior. You're paddling along and for 2 or 3 hours, and then all of a sudden you come out on Lake Superior, and it's just it's exhilarating. It's every time I do it, I love it. Fantastic.
Bob, thanks for calling. Have you done that, Jerry?
I have. I've had that experience, yeah, on many rivers, and I'm the same way. I never get tired of it. It lifts my heart every time to see all this immensity of water. And oh yeah.
Bob, thank you very much for calling. Jerry Dennis, our guest today, his book, The Living Great Lakes. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Jerry Dennis, our guest today, Jerry's book, The Living Great Lakes. And if you have a question, excuse me, I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. That's WPR.org. Love to hear from you. The summer before your trip on the Malabar, and you write about this in the book, you did the Chicago to Mackinac sailboat race. What was that like? You describe it well.
Yeah, that's a world I had never entered. I knew nothing about. I was naive enough to think that I could just talk my way onto a boat. You know, who wouldn't be honored to have a writer on board, right? And I just got laughed at. And people, they said, we don't want any dead weight on the boat. Get out of here. And but through a series of really lucky breaks, just pure coincidence, involving a crew member on one of the boats who fell and broke his leg, opening up a spot at the moment that I happened to be there, I got onto a boat and was able to experience this crazy day and night race up the length of Lake Michigan for 3 days, and ending at Mackinac Island at 3 a.m. And the whole town was partying, and that's just crazy. It was just a very different experience for me.
And you did another canoe trip, and I'm on Superior. You paddled the big lake in a replica Voyager canoe. And that had to have been a great experience.
And that was.
I liked one of your lines there. I think it was there where you were sitting in the canoe and you said it felt like resting on the back of a sleeping animal.
Mm.
I love that line.
Well, that was a good experience. I had always wanted to do a trip like that because I'd read so much about the Voyagers and their canoes and the 36-foot-long birch bark canoes. The replica that I was on was fiberglass, but it was, in every other regard, it was a pretty accurate replica. And there were 12 of us paddling, and I was amazed at how effortless it was and how fast the boat moves once you get going. And of course, we weren't carrying 2 tons of furs, but it was quite an experience. And we got windbound for a couple of days when a storm hit along the north shore of Superior, and that was spectacular. Just sat and tended a fire and watched the waves come crashing in.
Yeah, it was amazing. And you got into furs, and you told some interesting story about the Hudson Bay Company and all of the sort of the trading back and forth and what transpired with that.
Yeah, it was a huge industry. Before researching it for the book, I had no idea how much money was involved. It made millionaires out of the owners, and they mostly lived in the Boston and New York area, built big mansions. The Voyagers themselves were paid a pittance. The trappers, many of whom are Native American, were paid in cheap trade goods, like, you know, glass beads and cheap knives, hatchets, and all this money funneled into the pockets of a few people because there was a trend in Europe for beaver hats. I mean, it was the fashion. You weren't anybody if you didn't have a beaver hat. So the furs were being shipped across to Europe and were gobbled up at very high prices.
Yeah, good. Just it was an amazing, amazing story to me. And millionaires at that day and age, a million yeah. doesn't seem like as much today, but back then a million was a lot of money. Well, a million still is a lot of money, but it was a real lot of money back then. Let's put it that way.
Oh boy.
Treble in Lodi has a question or a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Treble.
Hi.
What's Hello. On your mind?
Well, I have a kind of a geographical observation to make for your guest and your listeners. As a young man, I was, I guess, 18 years old. I got a job working in Door County in a little art gallery. And then in the next year, I decided to travel in Canada. And I looked at a map, and liking Door County a lot, I observed that there was this place in Ontario on Lake Huron that looked exactly like, physically, like Door County. It was like a mirror image. And I ended up going there and finding some people and worked in an art gallery there for a couple of years. And it was an amazing place. Called the Bruce Peninsula, and the town was called Tobermory. I'm wondering if your guest has ever been there. There's a beautiful harbor there.
Yes, and it's really interesting that you noticed how similar it was to Door Peninsula, because they're both part of the Niagara Escarpment, the limestone formations that, you know, formed Niagara Falls. Arc over, all around Lake Michigan in a big horseshoe, and they are that outcropping of limestone is responsible for a lot of our rock features. And if you look at a map, the Bruce Peninsula and the Door Peninsula are almost identical. You're absolutely right. They're at almost the exact same latitude. They are about the same length. They even angle into the toward the center of Lakes Michigan and Huron at the same angle. It's pretty startling. You're the first person I've heard make that observation. So
that's pretty cool. And mentioning Lake Michigan and Lake Huron in the same sentence, they are the only two Great Lakes to merge, as you point out in your book, to merge freely, and the rest are connected by rivers.
Correct. Yes, that's true. So they are technically one lake, and the water currents go east one day and west the next, and there's this merging of not only the water but of the creatures that live in it.
Yeah. Helen in Little Chute has something for us. Hi, Helen.
Hi. I have a couple of brief comments. Thank you to the author for writing this book. I absolutely love the Great Lakes and worry about them, but thank you for that. I have 150 feet of shoreline on Lake Superior from my grandfather, and our beach is part of the Canadian Shield, and we have some of the oldest rock formations on Earth. So we have rock hunters continuously on our beach, which sometimes is a little bit of an issue. The next comment is the chief engineer of the Edmund Fitzgerald was a friend of my family's, and Harold had retired the year before the Edmund Fitzgerald sunk. So that was always significant in our family. And the last question, I married my husband and I was in Massachusetts for half my life, and our daughter spent her time on Cape Cod. And when she first got to Lake Superior, she said, "Mama, this is not a lake, it's an ocean."
Well, that's what it looks like, isn't it, sometimes, Jerry?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. A friend of mine hosted a party of Japanese tourists who came to Michigan. I think they were there for business reasons, and he volunteered to drive them around. And he took them down to the shore of Lake Michigan at the little town called Empire. And they exclaimed, they couldn't believe how big it was. And they kept, you know, through their translator, kept saying, insisting it was an ocean. And they marched down to the water, put their fingers in it and tasted it. And then they were just amazed. So my friend took them 10 miles up the shoreline to another public beach. They did the same thing. Each time they would go down and taste it because they just found it so hard to believe that this was not an ocean.
That's a great story. Jerry, is the book selling well?
Oh, you know, I'm just delighted with that. You never expect a book to continue to be read 20 years after publication. It just doesn't happen very often. And this book has just been pretty spectacular in that way. It's been a steady, reliable seller.
Well, it's I can see why. I've read it twice. I've enjoyed it. I enjoyed it both times. And Jerry, I thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It was a real treat and pleasure to be able to talk with you again. And I bet that that book's going to continue to sell for a long, long time. Thank you very much.
Hey, Larry. Let's do it again in 20 years.
Let's do it again in 20 years. Jerry Dennis, a freelance writer, public speaker, author, his book, The Living Great Lakes, Searching for the Heart of the Inland Seas. Take a look at it. Great to have him with us. And thank you so much for joining in today. And also a big thanks to our team, our producers, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnaud, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau, and I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.